Hello! Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the co-hosts would probably pee on the cones at the combine. You guys can guess which of those would be that person, or that dog rather. It's an exciting week in the NFL offseason. Combine week, it's like a little silly. There's a lot of goofy stuff that comes out of it, but I love it because it sort of marks a transition to draft season. That's season spelled S-C-N. It gets us our first look at the guys we're going to be talking about a lot over the next couple of months. We can start thinking about how they fit into the various teams. We can overanalyze and scrutinize the interactions between them and those teams. So we're going to be joined in the second half of the podcast by the professors who created the player assessment test, the PAT. When you hear about prospects at the combine taking a psych test, that's what they're talking about. It's different from the Wonderlic. It's something that's fascinated me for a while. It's been going on for a few years now, and the teams use it to try to evaluate players' mental, psychological, emotional makeup, things that will actually affect how they perform on the field. And there's actually been a demonstrated correlation between those results and performance on the field, which is very different from the Wonderlic. So I'm very excited to talk about that. But first, we are joined by a repeat guest, someone who is in Indianapolis. It's Field Yates, folks.
Hello, Mina. So let me ask you this. It's my second time on the show. How long after this podcast goes live do I expect some sort of gift in the mail? Like, I'm assuming you just gift every person that makes their second appearance. Yeah, I figured, like, at least a signed copy of, like, I don't know, like, do you have an official ESPN headshot that you could sign and personalize?
Well, I will post a picture of you being interviewed by Lenny, which is a gift in itself. It takes about 5 minutes for me to make.
I can't ask for anything more than that. You're right. I'll take my picture with Lenny. Really, that is the pinnacle.
I really hope Dominique Foxworth doesn't start asking for stuff, because I think he's been on 4 times.
Yeah, or 17 times, yeah.
Well, your name is very appropriate for today because you are in the field. You got to Indianapolis last night, right? So today is like the GM interview day. What's been the biggest piece of news that you've seen coming out of those interviews?
Yeah, I think the unquestioned biggest piece of news today is that Nick Foles will not be tagged by the Philadelphia Eagles. Yep. Remember about a month or so ago, Mina, there was at least a world that we could have envisioned where both Nick Foles and Le'Veon Bell received some sort of tag. Obviously, Le'Veon Bell, we got the information 2 or so weeks ago from the Steelers that he would not be tagged, and then Nick Foles not tagged by the Eagles. And it's a really interesting calculation, in my opinion, because if you're Philadelphia tagging Nick Foles, what it accomplishes is this. It probably guarantees you trade compensation, and it also allows you to dictate where he plays next year, at least in some part. But by not tagging Nick Foles, what it does, in my opinion, for Philadelphia is this. You probably are still going to get compensation in the form of a compensatory pick next year. It also means that you don't have to have $25 million in cap space available to put on the books for Nick Foles, because even if a player hasn't signed his franchise tag, he is still part of your cap calculation. So the minute you tag a guy, all of a sudden you got to be that much money under the cap. So I think that Philadelphia made a pretty calculated move here in not tagging Nick Foles.
Agree to me. You know, I saw some folks praising the Eagles for their kindness and generosity, which, you know, obviously they wanted to do right by Foles. But I also think, to your explanation, this made sense for them. And it also perhaps suggests that there wasn't an incredibly robust trade market for Nick Foles at that price. Now, we don't know that, but and soon we'll find out what actually the market for him is. You know, you and I are part of the NFL Insiders panel, and I just answered a bunch of questions about where I think Nick Foles will go and how much money he'll command. And as I was thinking through it, Field, and thinking through the different teams that need quarterbacks and might be willing to pay a veteran, it's not a lot of teams, right? Because Denver's got Flacco now. Washington needs a quarterback, but they're pretty pressed financially because of Alex Smith's contract. Miami is an option, but I don't think, like, they are in win-now mode exactly. They, to me, look like a rebuilding team, so I don't think it would be prudent for them to spend a ton of money on a vet. So you really kind of get to Jacksonville. Am I missing any teams that you think you know, would be potentially bidders for Nick Foles if the Eagles had decided to trade him.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Mina, you and I, well, I know this for you for sure, like, we like to think, not outside of the box, just for the sake of thinking outside of the box, but, like, you know, not just necessarily find ourselves awash in the groupthink, but right now the groupthink answer to where makes sense for Nick Foles is Jacksonville. But the reason why is because it's the team that actually makes sense for Nick Foles, right? And for a lot of reasons. First of all, who needs a quarterback who is, like, pretty good that can help them, like, go from, in their own minds, like, good to potentially great? And also, like, from a cap construction standpoint, like, this team knows that they are kind of, like, if they are a piece away, it's a quarterback, and they don't have the ability to, like, wait on, let's say they were to take Dwayne Haskins in the first round. Like, whether you think Dwayne Haskins is going to eventually be great or not, like, they don't have the time to wait on somebody like Dwayne Haskins or some other rookie quarterback. They need to do this now. And I always say that when a head coach or GM is announced as returning for the final season or for the next season, that means that, like, the pressure is on, right? When you have to announce that Doug Marrone and Dave Caldwell are returning for 2019, the pressure is on. So I think that Jacksonville knows it needs a quarterback upgrade, knows that the market right now is relatively slim. I mean, other than Nick Foles, you're looking at Teddy Bridgewater, Tyrod Taylor, I guess Ryan Fitzpatrick in terms of veteran options. And then, you know, the trade market is basically Case Keenum now. So I think that they make too much sense to not actively pursue them. Oh, by the way, Adam Schefter tweeted they might be interested too. So that right there sort of is the icing on the cake for the Nick Foles to Jacksonville train.
And you reported, I believe earlier today, that they're restructuring Darius's contract. There's just a lot of moves. They don't have a ton of cap space, but there's a lot of moves they can make in terms of releasing Bortles. That'll hurt, but you'll get about $4 or $5 million off the top of my head. I wouldn't be surprised if they move on from Malik Jackson, try to restructure Calais. So a lot to keep an eye on there. I want to read another quote to you. And I want you to give me your reaction to this. And this is also, I think, segues into some of the draft prospects we'll be seeing over the next few days. It is from Cardinals GM Steve Keim, who said, and this is a fun quote because the inflection really will affect what you think. I'm just going to read it in a neutral voice. Is Josh Rosen our QB? He is right now, for sure. What do you think, Field?
Well, can I start off by saying this, Mina, and I'm sure this is not at all applicable, but between Steve Keim and Cliff Kingsbury, the Cardinals definitely had the best-dressed head coach and general manager duo here today at the Combine. Like, this wasn't, like, standard-issue Arizona Cardinals gray sweatshirt that they were wearing today. Like, both of them brought the noise there, so no surprise.
It's a new era.
Now back to less important matters. Absolutely did I think that was noteworthy, and I wonder if, so normally it's the inverse, right, where, hey, a new GM takes over and everybody acquired by the previous GM is sort of on notice. Like, hey, there's no guarantee that you're going to stick around here. We saw it with John Gruden and the Raiders, even though he's the head coach, he's kind of the GM too. We've seen it with other situations, not just in football, but really in all sports. Now you turn to the inverse here where the GM drafted him, but, like, I think right now the sales job that the Cardinals are putting on is that, like, this is the Cliff Kingsbury era, not the Steve Keim era. Is that fair to say?
I think so. It's interesting, right, because you mentioned the GM still there, which is kind of questionable, you know, given some of the stuff that's happened in Arizona over the last years. But I remember when I had Matt Hasselbeck on the podcast and we were talking about Jameis Winston and whether the Bucs would move on. He said, Mina, if the organization that drafted the guy is still there, if the GM and another, again, GM that maybe some people thought wouldn't still be there, but if they're still there, they're going to hold on to that first round quarterback. And I think that's right. So that's why this is so interesting to me, because there's this potential conflict perhaps between the GM and the coach. And I think you're right to point out that they are building around this coach now, which is to me what throws this. I don't want to say there's a controversy, but there's a question at least.
Yeah, and the other thing I note about a quarterback investment is that it buys you at least 1 year of job security, right? Yes. If you are Steve Keim and you invest in Kyler Murray, number one overall pick, then that kind of gives you new life, I would say, right? Like, it makes you more, it gives you the chance to reinvent. I guess I just think that like it sort of breathes another sort of era into the Arizona Cardinals, and like you have this to look forward to. And I think that like that alone right there is something to be mindful of, like for Steve Keim, if he's going to draft a quarterback, is that like it kind of buys him almost like recharges the battery life a little bit too, right? Like, hey, it gives him a chance to continue to build this roster, and not just the quarterback spot, but a lot of other spots. Like, it's not like the Cardinals are a quarterback away from being competitive, right? They need probably more depth at wide receiver. The offensive line is a mess right now. The defense is pretty solid in some spots, but I think if you're the Cardinals, like, I understand that you invested in Josh Rosen last year, but there's a whole different level of investment when it's the number one overall pick in the draft if it's a quarterback. And I think, by the way, a lot of people would regard Kyler Murray as a prospect as superior to where Josh Rosen was last year.
Really? Okay, I want to get to that. First of all, I completely agree with what you're describing about GMs going for young guys and it gives them a new life, although it does sound a lot like Fyre Festival, as you're describing. But yeah, I mean, what is being an NFL GM if not running sort of a Fyre Festival in so many ways? But I'm very intrigued by the fact that you think Kyler is more attractive or perhaps has a higher ceiling maybe than Rosen. Would that be fair? I mean, so, you know, we've seen projections for Kyler all over the place. And so the QBs are being measured. That sounds so weird, but whatever. It's a combine. Everything about it's weird. Thursday, I believe, right? And then, the drills are Saturday. Yeah. So, but with Kyler, you and I know it's the measuring day is the day. So, like, how much does it matter? And what are is it height, weight, both, hand size? Like, what are people going to be looking at?
It's all of it, Mina. And yes, I understand why there are minimum thresholds. I do. Like, that's part of, like, you know, here's the reality about scouting is that there's like 256 guys here at the combine this week, but there's like thousands of prospects that are being filtered through by NFL teams right now. This is not some simple exercise and like, it's a fairly small pool and let's just make sure that we can get through the most important guys. Like, there are a ton of players that you are going through and a ton of players that, you know, we'll never talk about that NFL teams are filtering through right now and getting to the bottom of. So I understand why thresholds exist and they are important. I made this point recently on Twitter and I think it's one that maybe is actually like too nuanced for a single tweet, but there are very few occasions where the difference between a quarterback being good and great, or even bad and good, was merely a couple of inches of height, right? Like, it's really difficult to discern, like, hey, this player really, he would have been great if he'd been 6'3 and not 6 feet. There are quarterbacks that have overcome their height deficiency, and it's not like, you know, height is a precursor for success, like, if you're too tall. But I think that this stuff does matter for Kyler Murray, but I think, though, seriously, like, it's a little bit of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Like, if you really want it to matter, if you want to talk yourself out of Kyler Murray, well, then if he shows up at, like, 5.086, would be 5'8 3/4 inches, then you're going to be like, okay, dang, that's a problem.
First of all, I do think quarterbacks can be too tall. I've always been very against taking a quarterback
who's taller by name, Nina. Do that, okay?
He's on the list. Dan McGuire. I mean, there's... Listen.
Well, I think it can impact their delivery, right? If a quarterback is long, you know, the taller he is, the more likely he is to have longer arms. And the longer your arm, in most cases, it means the longer your delivery is, which can be a detriment to your point.
6'7", dude. I'm just saying, look back at NFL history. Look at all the quarterbacks who are over 6'6". It's not a pretty picture. The problem is it's unprecedented territory. Okay, right?
Like, sure. Yes.
If he comes in really small, it's going to cause concern. I don't even know what to say. Like, obviously, his tape speaks for itself, but I can't say a guy who's under 5'10", you know, it just hasn't happened, okay? So I think, to me, the numbers you're looking at are if he's under 5'10", if he's under 200 pounds, and if the hand size comes in under, like, 9.5. Because that's the thing about hand size. Like, Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, huge hands, okay? Little guys, huge hands. So I think if you get unprecedented numbers, I'm not saying that Mina Kimes personally believe that means Kyler Murray is doomed, but it means we're going to be talking about it 24/7 for the next 2 months.
Oh, no question about it. We've got 8 weeks of is 5'10 or 5'9 or 5'8 satisfactory. I think so. But the measurements ultimately, Mina, they are what they are, right? Like, He's not going to grow. He's not going to, you know, like if he puts on weight, it's like, a handful of pounds here or there between now and the draft. But like, we're going to have a view of what he is by Thursday. But here's what I would say about Kyler Murray, because I made a point earlier that kind of caught your attention in that, like, I think he has, I think he's more desirable than Josh Rosen was at this time last year. And this is there is a lot more to the evaluation than this. But one way that someone who's a lot smarter than me when it comes to football has positioned to this sort of conversation to me before is this. If you were to mention Josh Rosen as the number one overall pick in the draft last year at this time, even make it closer to draft day itself, it would have been talking yourself into Josh Rosen, right? Right now, it feels like the decision that the Cardinals are going to have to make is talking themselves out of Kyler Murray. There's a lot to like about him that you're going to be talking yourself out of. And I think that although he played in an offense that we have seen other quarterbacks succeed in, you can tell that there are a ton of traits that Kyler Murray possesses that are pretty unique that make him likely to succeed in a way that not a lot of other quarterbacks in this class, I think, are capable of. So ultimately, I'm not the one making the decision, and my draft opinion doesn't mean that much in the grand scheme of how the NFL sees it. But I can understand how tantalizing it's going to be to have to choose on between taking Kyler Murray and passing on him. Like, that's going to be a little bit of fear in that pill that you swallow when you pass on him.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Tantalizing is a great word, by the way, to describe him. And look, I still have a lot more Kyler Murray to watch. You know, I've watched him more than outside of Haskins, the other quarterbacks in the draft. But he does what Baker Mayfield did, which is he throws down the field accurately. And I'm just sorry. Like, if you can do that, you're a good quarterback. It's simplistic as the rubrics go, but for me, if you can do that, that's the bar. So Haskins is the other guy who I think, people seem to see as a lock for the top 10. We'll say that. Obviously, there's a lot of room for stuff to change. I mean, how do you see, like, what do you want to see from him this week? Do you think there's anything he can do to hurt or help his cause relative to Kyler?
Here's what I would want to see, Mia. I would want to see Dwayne Haskins light the combine up in the throwing drills. Yeah. Light it up. Like, leave no doubt who the best throwing quarterback is in this class. Because based off what we saw in college, I think there's a case that, like, Dwayne Haskins is the best thrower, and it may not be close amongst these quarterbacks. Now, I want to see it, though. And I think Dwayne Haskins checks a lot of the right boxes from a competitive standpoint. Like, there was never any mystery about whether he is going to throw. Like, he made it, it's clear he's going to. And, like, he seems to be ready to take on the challenge of what's ahead. I think that ultimately, though, like, it sounds somewhat silly to be talking about a dominant throwing performance at the combine when, like, you're throwing against no defense and the guys aren't even, no one's wearing pads. But my point is just, like, I think there's a chance, like, in the same way that if you think Kyler Murray is an exceptional athlete, like, it would be great for him to run the fastest 40 time and beat the 4.37 prop bet that has been propped up right now or that has been mentioned for his 40 time. So for Dwayne Haskins, I'd love to see him go out there and dominate the throwing, because I think there's a chance that he can separate himself in that regard.
I think we're going to see that from Drew Lock, and, that kind of Josh Allen style, like, bonkers. I mean, his arm is absurd. And it in is. The same yeah. way that I was still skeptical about Josh Allen, I'm going to continue to be skeptical about Drew Lock based on what I've seen. Sure. The arm is there. No one has, and I'm sorry, Drew Lock, for those who don't know, I'm speaking out the Missouri quarterback, who's being mocked. Where's he being mocked right now, Field?
I mean, I've seen as high as, like, 10 to the Broncos, right? Who, obviously, they traded, they're trading for Joe Flacco, but.
He's such an LA guy, too. Sorry.
Yeah, that's rich for my blood, Mina, but we know that supply and demand tells us, like, it's going to happen that he's going to be overdrafted, right? Probably relative to, like, if you were to grade the top 100 prospects and his number is, let's say it's 30, he'll go higher than 30, right? Probably a significant margin. If I can take a quick bend, this is not like a total tangent, but just as it relates to quarterback evaluation in the draft process, like, I think one of the things that I've always felt is really important to articulate is this, is that what's hard about the college quarterback evaluation process is digging deep on infrastructure in place around these quarterbacks. And, like, I loved Baker Mayfield last year. But any quarterback comes with some question marks, right? And I remember, like, not things that I didn't believe he could overcome, but things that I was curious about for Baker Mayfield. What happens when he is forced to play under duress? Because at Oklahoma, they had so much talent along the offensive line, you know, multiple offensive tackle prospects that were going to be, you know, day one starters in the NFL. They had such a good running game and such talented wide receivers that it was rare that Baker Mayfield was, you know, throwing the football under significant duress. We saw it a bit in the playoff game, and they got pretty well handled in that playoff game last year. So infrastructure is so important to be able to piece together, right? And I'm not, like, you know, Josh Allen's a good example. On the other end of the spectrum is that, like, the deck of cards, the hand that he was dealt was pretty, like, poor in 2017 relative to what other top quarterback prospects were playing with, right? And so I think that's always the rub, is that, like, it's a Drew Lock this past year. Like, Drew Lock was playing for a bad Missouri offense, but when he gets into a drill on Saturday, when he's throwing, people are going to say, like you said, Mina, like, this guy is ridiculous throwing the football. Okay, well, now you got to apply that into an offense of the NFL where maybe he's not playing with, I don't know, whoever, you know, maybe he's not playing with Chiefs wide receivers, but, you know, maybe he is playing with, like, an average wide receiver group and a good offensive line. Like, how does he look? I'm not the big quarterback, but, like, how would he look if he replaced Matthew Stafford? You know, like, reasonable receivers, you know, potential in the running game. Like, that's the part that I think is always so important for us to lock in on these quarterback evaluations. It's what did they do with the pieces around them, and then how will they fit with the pieces around them going forward?
Context, basically, in brief.
And
there's nothing.
Simpler way of describing it.
Well, and then the combine is the ultimate take things out of context situation, right? Because, we're going to get Drew Lock, and he's going to throw it really far, and a bunch of scouts are going to make, you know, odd faces, and we're going to get some quotes, but that doesn't really mean anything, other than that we know, he can throw it really far. And competition, it matters a lot. I mean, the four QB, so the landscape for those who don't know, you know, it's Kyler, Dwayne, and then we've got Drew Lock, and then Daniel Jones is, I would say, the fourth quarterback who's being kind of from Duke. And, you know, that's ACC, so it's not Josh Allen territory. But that's going to get so confusing this year when we talk about Kentucky Josh Allen. It's going to be a real problem. But again, you know, we're gonna watch these guys, and we're going to be talking about their abilities this week, but it really doesn't mean a ton separate from the context that you're describing.
Yeah. By the way, going forward, I'm just going to call Josh Allen of the Bills Jalen Ramsey's friend. That's how I'm going to refer to him as, just to make it easier. And then Josh Allen is the Kentucky, like, outside linebacker / defensive end. That's my new thing as of right now.
If Kentucky Josh Allen sacks quarterback Josh Allen, would that be the first time a quarterback is sacked by someone with his own name in NFL history?
I gotta figure it's one of the first times. Like, unless they're like, was there like a quarterback name like Michael Smith or like, you know, like.
Like a really generic one, yeah.
Yeah, like really generic, like, you know, common name, which, you know, is a Mina and Field podcast. We can certainly relate to these obvious generic run-of-the-mill names, right?
Yeah, not gonna happen to us. We're never gonna be sacked by somebody with our own name.
Okay. True.
I love Kentucky Josh Allen, by the way. So I started watching the pass rushers over the last week or so, and I'm in love with him as a prospect. I think he's phenomenal. I mean, he's raw. I mean, he's late. He's a late bloomer, right? And we'll talk about him at length. But the pass rushers are the story of the draft. I know we've been talking about the quarterbacks, and that's obviously going to be something we're going to talk about a ton. But this is just such a stacked draft for defensive linemen. And so I want to ask you, like, the guy that I think a lot of people are going to be looking at this week, because he's a guy who we haven't been able to look at over the last few months, is presumptive number one pick Nick Bosa, younger brother, of course, of Joey Bosa. So I'll just ask you flat out, is he still going number one? Again, obviously the Kyler stuff couldn't throw a wrinkle in that, and there could be trades, but is he still the number one prospect in this draft?
I think that's the appropriate question. The answer to me is yes. And, you know, when you're looking at players that are going to rush the passer, you have, like, you really have to be locked in on premium athletes. There just aren't that many guys that do it ugly right now in the NFL, like, just, like, sort of, like, maul their way to pass rush production consistently. Remember Derek Barnett from the Eagles, drafted a couple of years ago out of Tennessee, and it was, like, subpar athletic numbers relative to some of the other guys in his class, but like he has a pretty unique skill set where he can get by in a different way than some of the other rushers. But Nick Bosa has freakish athletic ability, freakish power, good instincts, and I feel like I'm maybe connecting dots here by assuming that because he played, or you know, his father played in the NFL and his brother does, that like that can at all be traced to his like advanced level of pass rushing moves. But I think he's got an advanced level of pass rushing moves. So I think that Nick Bosa checks a lot of the boxes that make him a ready-made prospect, provided that this core injury he's been not playing, or that he missed almost the entire season with, is fully cleared and there's like no ripple effects there.
Right. And so that's obviously something that's going to be tested, the combine. He has to pass the medical exams.
Yes.
And so I imagine we'll hear some, you know, a bit about that. And that's probably the most important part of the combine for him. I don't want to use Joey Bosa as his comp because it feels so lazy, but when you watch him, he just looks like Joey Bosa. And I'm glad you mentioned the moves because it's the moves, right? It's that swipe that just, it looks like Joey. I'm sorry. Like to me, before the injury, what I saw from him, you really just didn't see a lot of weaknesses in the game. He has it all. He has the athleticism. He has the moves. He has the speed. I think this will be a real chance for him to kind of come back into the spotlight, I guess, and remind people, oh, yep, I'm the number one prospect for a reason. You know, all the pass rushers, I mean, Ed Oliver is a guy I'm going to be really interested to see how he does this week just because, you know, he's not the biggest dude, okay? So the measurables are going to be there, but then the athleticism, I think, will give him up. He can show why he's still Ed Oliver. Rashawn Gary Field is a guy who I feel like could tear up the combine. A guy I don't love, by the way, as a prospect. I know. What are your thoughts on he's a edge rusher out of Michigan. What are your thoughts on him as a draft prospect?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So all these guys you just talked about all came in with significant hype, right? I mean, Ed Oliver was number one player in the country out of high school, chose to stay local, go to Houston. Nick Bosa, all the pedigree. Rashawn Gary, number one or, you know, like top two or three prospect as well, comes from New Jersey, goes to Michigan, has a long recruiting process, huge feather in the cap of Jim Harbaugh, et cetera. I think the question with Rashawn Gary is probably where exactly he fits, Nina. What is his most natural position? And I think the answer is that, like, in some ways it doesn't matter, right? Like, think about the Super Bowl and, like, some of the players that we saw make a major impact. Like, Aaron Donald does not align at the exact same spot every single snap. Or, like, Trey Flowers for the Patriots does not play at just one spot. But I think that Rashawn Gary is a player that, you're right, like, it never matched the hype at Michigan. He was really good. He's got special athletic traits.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing for edge rushers or these pass rushers that I think is a really important thing to keep an eye on, and Nick Bosa is probably the best at it in this class, is counter moves, especially in obvious passing situations. Like, teams know that you're going to be rushing the passer, right? But there are ways that they can do their best to deter your initial move. They can double team you. They can chip you with a running back, whatever it is. They can get the ball out quick. So it's not just what you can do when you first engage an offensive tackle. It's what you can do when all of a sudden you're playing from behind, when all of a sudden you don't win with your first step or your first initial move, your counter move, when you're facing a great offensive tackle. What happens when, you know, Tyron Smith gets his hands on you? What can you do? And that's where Nick Bosa really can separate, is that he's such a technician already, and he's, what, 21 years old? And that's hard to develop. Like, we're seeing guys come into their own as they get into a later stage of their career. Like, DeMarcus Lawrence all of a sudden has this massive arsenal of pass rush moves, which is why he will either be double tagged or he'll make a ton of money from the Dallas Cowboys this offseason. So these guys are works in progress, but what stands out about Nick Bosa is how ready-made he feels.
Yeah, and you mentioned counter moves. Again, Josh Allen, man, incredible counter moves. I mean, and flexibility. I mean, the way he moves sometimes reminds me almost of Von Miller.
Long.
Stuff that's it's not going to show up in the combine, right? Whereas a guy like Rashawn Gary, who I think sometimes is lacking in those areas, will beast out on some of these drills. So just to wrap up the drills and stuff, you know, every year you've got the players who dominate, Saquon last year. I think of Dante Jackson had a great combine. Josh Allen, the aforementioned Josh Allen, you know, the throwing.
Sure.
Yet we always debate what really matters. there's the famous, you know, Bill Belichick cares about the three-cone thing. And, you know, you hear that a lot. Three-cone matters more than some of the other stuff. The first 10 yards of the 40 matter more for certain positions. So what do you look at in terms of the drills? Like, what matters to you?
You know, I would say that I like to look at them as a cumulative reflection of a player, right? So rather than, like, if a guy is good in one category but, like, average in others, like, okay, is that one category particularly applicable to his position? So you mentioned the free cone drill and cornerbacks. Like, it's usually a sign of short area quickness and ability to change direction. You know, the long speed that is evident in the 40 is something to keep in mind if you have a vertical wide receiver. You know, position drills themselves are something to certainly keep an eye on. I think that those concentration drills that we see for the wide receivers and tight ends where they're going through, I guess they call it the gauntlet of catching the football. So what I would say, though, in terms of, like, what I'm most focused on is it does depend a little bit on position. But I think the reason why these drills are still relevant is as much as people are saying to themselves, like, how frequently does a offensive tackle run 40 yards in a straight line? And the answer is very infrequently, if ever. Like, it probably only happens when they're, like, celebrating a touchdown, when their running back has broken out into the, you know, into the third level and is just racing for 80 yards by himself. Like, remember when Adrian Peterson had that 95-yard run against the Eagles? Like, maybe Trent Williams ran 40 yards to help celebrate, but otherwise it never happens. But the reason why it's still relevant is that we've got 30 years or so of data compiled that shows, like, on average, here's where an offensive tackle finishes in the 40-yard dash. And then it's applicable. Like, hey, let's say there are, I don't know how many, let's just make this number up, 25 offensive tackles drafted in the first three rounds that ran a 5.4 or slower 40, and you look at those 25 and, like, you know, only five of them went on to start 45-plus games. Like, again, it's not merely because of their 40-yard dash time, but it might apply to, like, is it foot quickness? Is it something that is tied to the 40-yard dash in a different way? So that's stuff that I think I keep an eye on when it pertains to the data. It's just, like, are there outliers one way or the other that reflect potential success or potential red flags?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned, like, an offensive tackle, right? Because it was Orlando Brown Jr. who had the worst combine in NFL history. 5.85 second 40, the slowest of the event, and he had a pretty nice rookie season. So, yeah, you know, a good reminder to not put too much stock into all of this or to remember that there are certainly outliers. One thought, actually, as you're talking about the drills and whether they matter and which ones matter, I'm very curious to see with the running backs. I feel like the 4D might matter less now than the three cone or maybe the shuttles, just because of the way the position is changing and how much more they need to be used as pass catchers, how much more their change of direction perhaps matters. And so that's something I'd keep an eye on there with some of the backs in this combine. The 40, you know, it'll be interesting to see which guys are vying to top the John Ross, who's on the trade block. So again, the combine might not be that much. Although that there's a number of reasons for that, but so he's got that 4.22 40. I got to think guys like, Mecole Hardman, maybe out of Georgia, and my beloved Paris Campbell out of Ohio State could be vying to top that.
Yeah, he's a freak athlete, Paris Campbell, that's for sure. And then the stuff, you mentioned the word context earlier when we were talking about evaluating quarterbacks, and it applies to these athletic abilities. So you're right that, like, we get really fixated on, like, a running back's 40 time, and that's totally fair in some ways. I also look at it like this. Like, wide receivers are consistently running vertically. Running backs might be running vertically, like, on a couple of occasions a game where they actually have the chance to break free. So I'm looking at it more of like, okay, that short area quickness, which might apply more play to play, when you can make a guy miss in the hole, or you have to make a decision between sort of following the lane that it was intended to be blocked for, or taking a calculated risk to jab outside and try to get, you know, 7 extra yards on the perimeter. So I think that as much as the 40-yard dash is a made-for-TV event, the context of it is really important here.
Well, Field, as always, you provide that necessary context, and now you're gonna provide some answers because it's time for the final segment.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
We're doing this at the midpoint now, just because
I love you guys.
Ask Field
forever.
Question one: which combine drill would you do the best in?
The bench press, obviously.
How fast do you think you could run a 40?
I think like 4.95 is my guess. That's my I'm fairly
really so sub 5.
Yeah, sub 5. I'm putting
wow.
it out there. Yeah. Yep.
Wow, you're not the tallest guy. Do you?
Well, you know, but I'm deceptively tall though. Actually, deceptively.
What? Wait, but are you like a runner?
I'm a long distance runner. I'm not Dan Stanzik level, but I do enjoy some time on the treadmill. It's been a while since I've run a 40-yard dash, probably since like my senior year of college 10 years ago. But I would think that I could at least hold. Like the good news is like I could at least run 40 yards. Like if you told me to run like a half marathon right now, like I'd probably stop after a few miles, but I can make it 40 yards.
There was this bit on Levitard's show for a while last year about racing each other and who would win in a foot race, and there was a foot race, and I was bragging a ton about how I would crush them, but I didn't realize it was a 100-yard dash. I thought it was like a mile, and I'm like you. I run, but obviously I'm not large. I don't have very long legs, so I think I would probably get – I don't think I would be super impressive on a 40. But if it was a mile –
Yeah, that's true.
Then
that's,
I think –
That's a good point.
Really
a mile I take you every day of the week.
10. Question 2, how excited are you about Detective Pikachu?
Very excited. Like – I think that I've been looking forward to that longer than like subconsciously more than I've consciously realized it. So I'm ready. Like I'm all in. Give me it now.
Did you watch Pokemon as a kid?
A little bit growing up. Like my sister was like Pokemon obsessed. So I definitely got it definitely rubbed off on me a little bit. Super Smash Brothers. I used to mess around with Pikachu quite a bit too, which was good. So yeah, I mean like if it'd be impossible to ignore their presence growing up, I'm ready. Between that and the Lion King, like I'm ready for some good movies coming up.
Animated movies are kind of the best movies these days, I feel like. I actually played Pokemon on Game Boy when I was a kid.
So. Feels like a little bit of a brag, but I'll let it fly in this case.
I love comparing NFL players to Pokemon.
Okay.
Mike Tolbert is absolutely Bulbasaur. Question 3.
Say Jigglypuff there or something like that.
I try to keep it nice. I feel like actually I have compared someone to Jigglypuff.
That was mean by me. Yeah.
That's, you know, Jigglypuff is so adorable though. What is a draft take that you were wrong about last year or that you've adjusted or calibrated how you felt at the time? Field and I did a draft show together last year, reacted live to the draft picks. So you saw our takes in real time. I know, got one in mind for myself, but I'm curious about you. Is there anything that you think, maybe I misjudged it?
You know, I thought Marcus Davenport would make more of an immediate mark for the Saints. I really did. And I don't disagree with the pick, and I know that he had the thumb issue that bothered him a little bit. There's a chance for him to turn it around, but I thought that one would be one. And then I did not think that Jaire Alexander would be as much of a star as he is right away.
I liked him a lot. Davenport, I mean, just seemed like so much to give up for him at the time. And obviously, they're going to.
Yeah, two first rounders, whatever it was. Remember 27 and 31.
Didn't we think we thought they were trading for Lamar, I feel like, too.
I thought that was happening.
When the trade came in. Yeah. I liked Baker Mayfield. I should have loved Baker Mayfield. That would be mine. I mean, he surpassed my expectations. And as I mentioned, he had a lot of the characteristics of a college player that I really like, but I still had Sam Darnold as my number one over him, and obviously Baker Mayfield was the best rookie quarterback last season, and it wasn't particularly close.
But there's a lot of football left in all those guys' career. I'm not trying to take away.
Yes.
I agree with you. Baker Mayfield was unquestionably the best rookie quarterback, but there's a lot of football left. I'm excited to see what Sam Darnold looks like because I think that the cast of characters around him will be much better this year.
Baker was in the best situation, I think, and took advantage of that. And so, question 4, speaking of situations, gun to the head, where's Antonio Brown playing next year?
I'm still going Green Bay Packers. That's my just, like, total gutting.
Really?
Yep.
Ooh, that's not a super common one. So why do you think so?
That's like warm takey. I don't think this is your same old Green Bay Packers. To part with it, like, you know, this is not your father's Green Bay Packers. They've always balanced a good cap sheet. I think it will make a lot of sense because it accomplishes Pittsburgh's goal of getting him out of the conference and to a team that they won't see again until 2021. I just sort of feel like there is a little bit of a need for Green Bay to infuse the offense. You obviously know Aaron Rodgers a lot better than I do. And I don't know that it's fair to always evaluate body language for an athlete entirely, but it just felt like he was frustrated last year with the supporting cast, and it was almost like, we don't have time to waste time around here. So that's my guess. That's obviously just a guess, but that's my, you know, if I had to make a choice, that would be my pick.
I love that idea. I'm very curious to see.
By the way, have the 30th pick in the draft, which to me is the exact sweet spot to acquire Antonio Brown.
Yes. Yes, totally. And it would be worth it. It would be absolutely worth it. And
oh my God, Mina. If people are now overthinking it so hard on Antonio Brown, it's crazy.
I know! It's bananas to me that
Brown.
And his contract is a great value, okay? He's
so
just
value.
30.
Yep.
He led the league in receiving yards 2 seasons ago, touchdowns last year, and he's freaking Antonio Brown. He runs the best routes in the NFL. Like, it's insane to me. I know people are saying, well, you know, the mustache and the tweets, but I actually think Green Bay would be an excellent landing place for him in that regard.
I mean, like
Aaron Rodgers.
I really do.
The mustache is a problem, but Aaron Rodgers, I'll just say, about him, you know, there's always questions like, well, you know, is he going to respect the coach? Is he willing to make changes? Whatever. Game recognized game is something that applies to him.
I completely agree on that. Yep.
And
yep. I completely agree.
He has not had an Antonio Brown, man. And I know, you know, like Devontae Adams is great, but like, I would just love to see, I think Matt LaFleur's offense is going to be much more reminiscent of a Kyle Shanahan offense than people are predicting. And I would love to see Antonio there. Oh, you got me excited now. Oh,
just a
gosh,
thought.
I hope
just
that
a thought.
Happens.
Throw that one away.
All right, Field. Last question, as always, comes from Lenny. Field, I follow you on Instagram. Your wedding isn't for several months, but you already have a hashtag. My question is, how many brands are sponsoring the big day?
This is my call to action. Thank you, Lenny, for the great question. Big time, long time fan. None that I'm aware of yet, but we can use some brand awareness.
Like
if anybody wants to jump in, vendors-wise, I'm in.
You like Nick Jonas's wedding was entirely sponsored. You're kind of like the Nick Jonas of ESPN.
I'll take it. I will wear that cap with significant pride. But if anybody wants to jump into the foray, please hit me up. Comment on my Instagram post. DM me on Instagram. Whatever it takes. If you want to help contribute, like anything to listen, I'm in.
Yeah, I feel like you should get something.
I mean,
what's the hashtag? I don't actually know.
Yeah, my fiance's name is Chapin. Chapin takes the field. So I actually think it's kind of witty, if I'm being honest with you. Like, it's not corny.
No, it's good.
Witty. Thank you.
Your name, though, is, like, so conducive to hashtags and, like, you know, cute little names.
It really does.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I recommended Field Notes as a podcast for you once. Or like a little
trust
segment.
Me, I want to get
SportsCenter.
Them to sponsor me. That's another sponsorship. Field Notes.
Field and Stream. Field. I mean, there's just a lot you can do with that.
Off from the field, living the stream, living the stream, living the field,
playing the field,
something like that. Playing the field.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long from the combine. I know you got a lot of work to do there, but thanks as always for coming on, and we'll see about that gift, buddy.
You are the best, Mina, and enjoy Boston this weekend. Can't wait to hear all about Sloan.
So this is a real treat. As you heard earlier, I talked about all of the things that happen at the combine that you don't see. Really, it's the things that you don't see that are the most important things, the interviews, the medical exams. And when you look at the schedule, I mentioned that, you know, you might be familiar with the Wonderlic, but there's also a psych test, and that's called the Player Assessment Test, PAT. It's clever, right? And it's been going on at the combine since 2013. And I've always been fascinated by, you know, what it entails, how it relates to the Wonderlic, which is a test I've been vocal in the past about having some issues with and having issues with the discussion of it. But I've been very interested in this test, and I'm really excited to be joined right now by the two guys who created it and who will be administering it in Indianapolis this week. So their names are Ken Yesko at the University of Maryland and Harold Goldstein at Baruch City University of New York, two professors of industrial and organizational psychology. Guys, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
First, I wanted to start off by asking you about why this was created in the first place. And again, it's called psychological tests, and I think, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And you know, the Wonderlic has been around for a long time. For those who don't know, the Wonderlic is often defined as an intelligence test, but like most standardized tests, again, this is my opinion, I think it has a lot of flaws in terms of helping us understand what makes people good at football, and you could argue what makes people intelligent and able to operate in the world, and that it brings a lot of socioeconomic, some would say racial biases into the picture. And I know from my own experience in interviewing players who have had their Wonderlic scores leaked over the years, we all know some of the famous leaks have been associated with players who have then gone on to be excellent but have had low scores or vice versa, that there's a lot of issues with it. So I was wondering how that factored into your guys' decision to create this test and how you went about creating it in the first place back in 2013.
In our discussions, this is Harold Goldstein. In our discussions with the league, they had talked to their clubs, and it seemed like the clubs wanted expanded psychological information on the players. So they wanted information on intelligence as well as on other types of personality and psychological factors, like being team-focused, being a leader, being prepared. So it seemed like in their discussion with various clubs, they wanted an expanded psychological test. So that's why they reached to us to see if they could get something that was broader than what the Wonderlic provided.
And you actually, when you created it, you were working with Cyrus Mary, right, who was one of the guys who helped establish the Rooney Rule.
Right. Cyrus had worked closely with the league on a lot of the things that try and move it forward and look to progress over time. And so in his discussions with the league, they went out, I believe, together and spoke to the clubs, and they focused on the need for a broader set of measures around a broader set of psychological dimensions.
Well, how did you guys go about figuring out what mattered? Okay, because, again, I've seen, like, Wonderlic questions, and they do kind of look like SAT-style questions, but as I understand, your test is very different, and you're looking to test very different things.
Yeah, so we followed the same recipe we use outside of sports, and that is the first thing is to do a very intricate analysis of the job. So we met with all kinds of GMs, league executives, players, coaches, and we got input on the specific psychological characteristics that they thought would result in better performance. And we then developed test measures to try and get really good insight into each of those dimensions. As Harold said, instead of general intelligence, we kind of looked at things like avoiding mental errors, making quick decisions, ability to learn plays. On the personality side, how prepared are you? How dependable are you? How team-focused are you? In terms of self-control, are you able to avoid emotional outbursts, that kind of thing? And then the key piece is we looked at performance statistics. After the players were in the league, we got detailed input from each of the teams on the performance of each of the players, and that included things like coaches' ratings, on-field statistics, and other metrics. And we were very focused on linking what we said originally about the players in terms of their psychological characteristics and how they actually played.
Well, I want to talk about the performance and what you found in terms of this test's kind of ability to predict that, because I think that's really interesting. But you mentioned a lot of things that I don't think of as being easy to test, right? Like you talked about, for example, learning plays, but your test isn't actually, you know, going through an install with players. How do you go about evaluating them on something like that using a standardized test?
We try and get at the underlying capabilities psychologically that they would need to then be able to do those activities. From our study of industrial organizational psychology, we focus on human capabilities and trying to understand all the different intellectual and cognitive ones, as well as the more psychological personality temperament ones. And so by having kind of a map of what are the underlying capabilities that a human being has, you can then tie them directly to the kinds of activities that they can do and how well they'll do them.
So examples might include testing things like your ability to make decisions when there is incomplete information, when the situation is very ambiguous, or your ability to make quick decisions around direct processes that are well defined, or your ability to avoid making mistakes in different situations. And so we tailor the testing around each of those mental facets and then make sure they're relevant for the field.
Going back to how you, again, put together those facets in the first place, you mentioned talking to a lot of GMs. I think GMs, many of whom are still in the league, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was there anything they said that in that process, again, when you were putting together this test, that surprised you in terms of qualities maybe you wouldn't have thought going into this would have been important to evaluate players?
What was interesting is we talked to them independently. So we worked with the GM council at the time and spoke with them independently of what was the formulas for success, what was going to differentiate whether a player would succeed or fail. And they used different words to describe it, but across the majority of them, it was amazing how consistent they were. The one thing that stood out to us and that kind of came together at the end was the focus on being able to perform under stress. So you can look at these different types of capabilities that people need, but the question becomes, can they perform them when they're under duress?
Every player at the combine takes this, correct?
Yes. Knock on wood, so we've had 100% of the players take the test since 2013.
So they're sitting at a computer, and the test is, what, like an hour about?
Yes, about an hour.
So I know you can't give out, you know, the specific questions, but I'm trying to understand, you know, if you're a prospect, let's say a quarterback prospect, and as you said, being able to make decisions under pressure is really, which makes a ton of sense when we think about football and especially, you know, the things that make certain players great. It really resonates with me. But I'm wondering, like, when you're sitting in front of a computer, what does that look like? Is there a timer on a question? Is it doing a puzzle really quickly? Like, just generally speaking, how do you even test for that kind of thing?
There's really a wide range of activities, and a computer can administer a wide range of things. Things that are timed fast, things that are timed slow, different types of stimuli, which could be puzzles. It could be questions about how they prefer to behave that we've seen over the years link to underlying psychological capabilities. So they get a wide range of things. The computer can walk them through the entire test, so it's administered completely in a standardized way by the computer.
Hmm. But it is like puzzle-type things, yes?
Yes, some puzzles, some speeded puzzle-type problems, some moving figure problems, some personality questions about what you think are priorities.
Some questions about their past history, which tend to predict how they'll behave in the future. Well, one of the things Ken and I believe in is using a wide range of valid ways of measuring something and then converging that data together. We tend to find that leads to the best measurement of things that, as you mentioned, are difficult to measure.
This description is really, it's stressing me out thinking about, although I'm very good at Tetris, so maybe I would be.
You can take it if you want.
Oh, God. I don't know. I'll think about that one. But the other thing you mentioned is the emotional aspect of this, which you're also testing for. And that, how do you even begin to test for that kind of thing? Like you talked about sort of, I don't know, emotional stability, which again, when you think about sports and you think about these guys and what makes them good and you think about all of the great NFL players and what you learned about their personalities and the ice in the veins, it makes 100% sense that that's important and that that foretells success, but I can't even begin to imagine how you test for that kind of thing.
Yeah, asking their questions about how they react to various types of scenarios, asking questions about how they view certain types of things, we know from the research and studying that we do that that can link back to their ability to control certain types of behavior. And when we're talking about emotional stability, we're talking about passion and energy much more than emotional stability in other settings. So we're using combinations of questions about their preferences and the way they see their world in ways that through our algorithms link back to an indicator on a scale of how high or low they are on a certain capability.
It sounds complicated. It doesn't sound like A, B, C, D kind of thing.
It is complicated, and the questions are rooted in all kinds of literature and past kinds of assessments that have worked. But one thing to keep in mind is that when these questions are used, there's always a check. We make sure that the decisions we make based on the test match what the player does on the field in terms of performance and also the way the coaches see that player. So we close the loop by devising these questions that we think work, but then we always, year over year, check to make sure the questions actually predict and are in line with how the player plays and how the coaches see those players.
So kind of what you're saying is you'll ask these questions evaluating an athlete's ability to make decisions under pressure, and then you'll see how well does he actually make decisions under pressure, and then you'll go back and recalibrate the test to, you know, reflect the results you're seeing on the field.
That is absolutely true, and we've had great stability now in the last few years, so we haven't had to recalibrate so much as add additional kinds of items. But that concept of showing that the test works is absolutely critical. We call that validation. And in our field, in industrial organizational psychology, Harold and I work in a lot of legal contexts. So we have an obligation to show that the test actually does what it says it's going to do. And that's based on being professors, where we look into the research part, but also good practitioners that have certain legal obligations to make sure the work is well done.
Smart way of saying we have to prove it actually works. That's always been my frustration, I guess, with the Wonderlic is we, every year there's this test and the results are leaked and we talk about them like they matter so much, and it bothers me because there's no correlation. I mean, it hasn't been proven that they matter. In fact, I've recall a few years ago reading that in some positions there was actually a negative correlation where guys with lower scores were playing better at certain positions. So it's very compelling to me that you've gone back and sort of checked your work here. How did you go about checking your work? Like, so you mentioned you've spoke with coaches. What about on-field performance? Does that factor into sort of how you check the test as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, one thing, the NFL was fantastic in making a commitment. They understood this notion of validation. And so they committed to confidentially surveying each team about players after they had played for them for a year. So that was incredibly helpful to get that kind of data back. And the teams have been incredibly helpful in that they're willing to share that kind of confidential information. So we use that as one part of validation. And then from there, we started linking to the on-the-field data. And we're seeing those relationships hold. They're a little harder to project, you know, because once you're on the field, there's so many factors that can impact how you perform, from getting injured to are you playing behind a Pro Bowl player so you're not getting on the field yet. But we are seeing those links and those correlations to on-the-field things, even down to how many penalties you cause and the yardage per penalty. We're seeing correlations that are significant to the test scores.
The penalty thing is interesting because, yeah, I was wondering, you're testing for decision-making and performance under pressure. And so I was, as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, huh, like would a guy who jumps off sides a lot, would that be something that maybe, I don't know, you could, I don't want to say predict, obviously you can't predict that, but is that something that you might be able to see a correlation between something you guys are testing for and those numbers?
Well, that's exactly the point. And if you didn't see that correlation, we wouldn't be comfortable saying this is a person who's going to jump off sides a lot. So what we would do, for example, is we have a variable called stress tolerance, and that's a measure of whether you get rattled under pressure. But then we also combine that with your ability to make good decisions. And we have a variable we call decision-making under stress. That variable actually predicts penalties. And you can see why. Someone is under pressure, they make a bad decision, and they get more penalties.
Going back to sort of the standardized tests in general, again, some of the issues that I'll just speak for myself, the issue that I take with a lot of standardized tests is that they don't account for biography and all of these various factors I alluded to earlier, race, socioeconomic factors that can change the way people perform on tests and maybe, you know, muddle the picture. How do you guys, with your testing, sort of block all of that out, all that noise?
One of the things that Ken and I have done a lot of research on now for about 15 years is on building tests of the intelligence domain with low socioeconomic status interaction, with low racial differences, with low gender differences. And so that's an area of research for us as professors for the past over a decade at this point. So we use a lot of those principles in the way we measure intelligence, and that tends to lead to a reduction in any kind of differences based on race or gender.
But you're raising a really good point. Tests have so many challenges, and they're so complicated in predicting real-world performance that they're not perfect. And so your job is to collect all of the information you can in terms of physical ability, in terms of past experience and success, say, in college, and in terms of other variables that matter, like psychological characteristics. And you put as much information together, and you make the best prediction you can. And that's why you can't over-rely on any one instrument or any one approach. Everything gets considered together, and then you combine things as best you can.
Teams hire additional psychological testers to use their own tests as well. And what we always speak to the teams about is combining all of this together, meaning that one positive of our test, the PAT, is it's done league-wide, so everybody gets all that data. But teams should combine this with what they saw in interviews, with their own additional psychological tests that they use, and because none of these are infallible or perfect.
Do you guys consider all of, like, you know, obviously you're seeing... Well, I don't know if you're seeing the results of other things. I'm wondering if you have seen players who have shown like great learning ability or decision-making under pressure on your tests, but then maybe didn't do so well on the Wunderlich, for example.
Yeah, you know, we don't see the other data just like the other test developers don't see ours. And that's just, you know, kind of professional courtesy not to do that. Not to combine the data together ourselves. So the teams are doing that, but we don't see it.
They're seeing it, yeah.
But one thing I would say is we're all about converging data. So the scouts might have some really good insights into things like personality. You might have other team-based psychological assessments. You'd have the NFL league-wide test, which is us. And when you put it all together, if things don't match, then you say, okay, well, why? And that might raise a red flag.
Yeah.
And then you go out and get more information so you can be more comfortable you're coming to a good decision. So just because things don't match doesn't mean you can't use that information to make a good decision ultimately.
Yeah, I'm very drawn to the idea of considering it all together, right? Because, again, with the public, all we see is the leaked Wunderlich scores, which should not be leaked in the first place. And I know... I've seen athletes, NFL players, who have had low scores, and then I've seen their tape, and I know they're great at processing information. That guy's a great decision maker. So I'd be fascinated. I imagine your work is kind of filling in the rest of that picture for teams. And beyond that, you're also, as I understand it, working with teams afterwards to kind of give them advice on how to coach and manage these players with the information you've collected.
Yeah, it was very interesting. When we started this, it was all about helping pick the best people. And that was very successful. And then we started getting calls from the club saying, well, we have the people now. What can we do to get them to be even better? And so we started sending coaching reports out that helped, based on the psychological assessment, helped coach the players in the best possible way. We also started working with coaches on how to coach different players differently.
Can you give me an example of maybe something, I don't know, that you've taken away from that in terms of how to coach a certain kind of player based on what you've learned about them psychologically?
Yeah, one of my favorite examples is when you look at confidence around making good decisions and then ability to make good decisions. And sometimes you get players that are incredibly confident, yet they don't have great decision-making ability. You would coach that player very differently than someone who is not confident about their decision-making abilities, who actually make great decisions. And so you would address those in very different ways.
I would consider myself more in the latter group. How do you coach someone who's not super confident about their decision-making ability?
If they have strong abilities and you're trying to get them to be more confident, then you know, some of the things we talked to them about is giving them more direct feedback, trying to show them how successful that they'll be, try and stop them from dwelling on times they've made errors. So it's a question of the coach being aware that this is a disconnect for the player,
yeah,
and that they can help them, you know, try and have the right perspective on their capabilities.
It's interesting because I, again, profiling players, spending a lot of time with them, sometimes with certain positions, for example, I think cornerback, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true, which is that you want guys who have a short memory and don't dwell on their mistakes, because playing cornerback, most of the time you're not noticed unless, you know, you get burned for that one pass or something or a touchdown. Is that something you guys consider, like positional variance or qualities that can make someone good at the game that wouldn't necessarily be viewed as like a wonderful personality trait off the field?
Yeah, that's a great question. But, well, it's a couple of questions you just asked. But one thing for sure is that we've been moving over time to really understand the positions and what specific attributes each position needs and how they vary across. And up until now, we've really worked on a core set of qualities that work for all players, but we're starting to focus on individual aspects for each of the individual positions. You know, some of the things that might be considered negative that in certain cases may be a positive on the field, you know, in terms of holding your teammates accountable, right? When we think about being a good teammate, it's not just about being a nice person. That may be a factor, but you also sometimes have to be a little bit tough with some of your teammates and hold them accountable and push them. So that might be an example of a characteristic that's viewed as a little bit tough off the field, but very sometimes useful on the field.
I'm very curious to see what you guys find about quarterbacks, because obviously that's the position we think the most about. We think just in terms of psychology, leadership, mental makeup. I know it's early and you're obviously still working on, you mentioned earlier, you know, how to assort these traits to various positions, but is there anything you have seen already or noticed that makes for a good quarterback mentally?
I mean, I think the intelligence factors are crucial for the quarterback. I mean, you certainly want some of the personality factors that'll make them a leader and make them dependable, those kinds of things. But the intelligence factors, the visual aspects of intelligence are crucial. The quick decision-making under speed, the ability to learn in-depth information and see things is critical. And we certainly see those standing out a lot when we look at the quarterbacks. Even though it's really a small sample of quarterbacks, even though we've been doing this since 2013, it's still a small, relatively small group.
Yeah, one interesting thing about the quarterbacks is looking at their what we call complex thinking. And when plays break down, when things are ambiguous, when things go wrong, can you recover and make good decisions? And so you might be a quarterback who can learn the plays perfectly, and when everything works, you execute perfectly. But then there are other quarterbacks, when things break down, they really shine in making something out of nothing.
Well, that's certainly something I think that passes the eye test when you're watching football. So it makes sense that it's something that you would want to try to test for. Well, so tell me about this week. What do you guys, so it's every player. How are the next few days going to play out for you?
Yeah, we'll do 4 days of testing, just like the four on-field days. So we'll test the different groups. It's the day before they do their physical workout. So we test them in the morning along with the Wunderlich, and we get that all out of the way in the morning.
All right. So last year you guys presented on the results you had gathered at Sloan. This weekend I'm hosting the NFL analytics panel we do every year, and we'll be talking about all of the ways in which teams try to gain an edge through the statistics they're gathering on the field, you know, now with player tracking data, some of which is available to the public. What you're describing is data that's not available to the public. And I'm wondering, is this something that you think teams can use and their analytics departments can use to gain an edge in terms of not just player evaluation from a draft and free agency perspective, but how to actually coach those players once you've got them?
Teams have gotten pretty good at basic analytics. Billy Beane says a dollar worth of analytics in the past is now worth 50 cents because all the low-hanging fruit has kind of been gathered. So as basic analytic approaches spread throughout the league, the competitive advantage drops a little bit. In response, teams have been trying to develop ever more sophisticated analytical approaches, and that's a great source of competitive advantage. The other source of advantage is to add data that nobody else has. And psychological data tends to be proprietary data that no one else has, and you can add it to the mix to produce an overall picture of the player that nobody else has.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this really interesting stuff. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us. It was a pleasure.